Well, if he unmutes, they can hear him.
Yeah, okay. Yes, that's true.
How are we doing now? Is this better?
Yeah.
And you want this on? Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Joan. Christina. Mark. Brian. Phil. Paulette. Yushay. Bob. Mary. Chris. Camille. Emilia. Karen. Deborah. Dennis. Marv. And in the Zindo. Cinda.
Judith.
Ginryu.
Linda.
James. And I am Thomas. Okay. Would you make Usho, please? Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I don't know if this is my fourth or fifth time with you, but I have been watching your evolution as a Sangha from the very beginning, and it's been very exciting to watch your journey and to be just a little part of your journey once in a while. I want to invite you to think this morning together about the ebbs and flows of our practice. And I want to start by reading one of my favorite quotes of all time. This is by Dainin Katagiri. And Katagiri was a Japanese priest who was a very important and influential figure in helping bring Zen from Japan to the West, and particularly the Midwest. While Zen was flourishing on the coasts, he was founding Minnesota Zen Center and was the abbot there for some time. And this is what Katagiri wrote about our practice. The changes that occur through spiritual practice are not really your business. If you try to make them your business, you will try to change your life directly. If you try to change your life directly, no matter how long you work at it, you will not satisfy yourself. So, if you truly want to change your life, you should just form the routine of doing small things day to day. Then your life will be changed beyond your expectations. There is no explanation for this. I'd like to ask you to reflect for a second on two things. What brought you to practice? And when I ask you what brought you to practice, I don't mean at a meta level, at a macro level. I came to find global peace and equanimity in the world. I mean on a much more practical level. What was happening in your life? What was happening in your head? What was happening in your heart? What were the conditions of your life at the time? Why then? What brought you then to practice? Whether it was 6 months ago, whether it was 25 years ago. Can you recollect that? Can you recollect what life was like, what you were like, what the conditions were like, what was happening, where you were in life at that time? Now here's the second question. Why are you still here? And again, whether that's been 3 weeks or it's been 25 years, why are you still here? And not why are you still here again on this big meta, macro, global, conceptual level, but on a practical level. Your life today, the conditions of your life today, what's in your head and what's in your heart, and why are you still here? When I came to practice, I really was quite big on myself. I really thought I was a Renaissance man. I had a good life. I had a cute little house. I had two amazing dogs. I had a fantastic partner. I had a great career. I had all kinds of interesting civic volunteer engagements and positions. I came from a good family that I had good relationships with. I had interesting friends that I liked. I really thought I was kind of all that. But there was one piece of my pie that was missing. I had no spiritual path or no spiritual practice of any type. So being the type A accomplishment-oriented, get it done, be successful guy I was, I needed to figure out something to fill that slice of the pie. And then I would be a real Renaissance man, because then the whole pie would be complete. I would be lacking nothing. It would all be balanced. So I came to practice seeking that piece of the pie. That's why I came. And boy, was that idea upended right away. I don't know about you, but in the 20 years since that time, my practice has reflected the ebbs and flows of every other thing I am in relationship with in my life. It has mirrored the ebbs and flows in my career. It's mirrored the ebbs and flows in my marriage or my relationship. The ebbs and flows of friendships. The ebbs and flows of relationships with family. The ebbs and flows of health as I age. The ebbs and flows of finances over the years. There have been moments of great highs, the flow, and moments of ebbs, which would be the opposite of the flow, and a lot of time somewhere in between. So, I wonder if you might think for a moment about your own practice, whether that's been 3 weeks or 25 years, and stop and think for just a second about the major, not every, but the major ebbs and flows. If you were to chart out or graph out or visually depict the primary ebbs and flows of your practice, what were they? When were they? What did you do with them? How did you greet them? How did you manage or not manage or navigate through them? What came next? How did you greet that? How did you navigate that? What patterns do you see? What recurring themes do you discover? More flow? More ebb? Rapid changes between ebb and flow? Long periods in between? Here are some common ebbs and flows experienced by lots of convert practitioners, and I mean people in the West who weren't born and raised in a Buddhist home, in a Buddhist nation, with a Buddhist culture. So convert folks like me to Buddhism. So when I first came to my practice, I was amazed. I remember thinking, oh my goodness, this is amazing. This is fascinating. This is so rich. This is so interesting. This is so deep. This is so complex. This is so challenging and interesting and wow. Wow. How many of you resonate with some phase of wow? Raise your hand or nod or thumbs up or something. Not all of you. Sounds like some of you. Yeah. Another phase that followed was, what on earth am I doing? How am I entering? How am I bowing? How am I sitting? Am I sitting right? Am I chanting the right way? Am I too loud? Am I too soft? Is my posture right? What is this bell and what is that thing? And am I doing it the right way? What am I missing? Am I mucking it up? And kind of a period of confusion and intimidation. And I got very caught up in that for a period of time. How many of you have been through that phase? The phase of confusion, the phase of intimidation. Am I doing it right? What am I doing? How do I do it? Raise your hand. For those of you that missed that phase, congratulations. Another phase that's common is the phase of everyone's doing this better than I am. Their practice seems so much stronger than my practice. The way they sit seems to be so much steadier than the way I sit. When they speak, they just sound like they have so much more equanimity, or their grasp of the sutras and the teaching, the way that they articulate things, how often they're here, the steadiness with which they practice. She's doing it better. He looks like he's doing it better. I wonder if she may be doing it better because I'm not. Any of you resonate with that phase? Projecting on to other people the fact that somehow their practice must be free of all of the mishmash that's happening in my body and in my head, and that somehow I'm just not doing it right enough. There have been also moments in my practice when I was incredibly moved and touched and inspired and motivated and filled with brightness and filled with gratitude, and sometimes I felt like my heart would burst. I remember coming back from a Dai Jukai retreat, where the teacher showed us their silks that they received when they were transmitted, and laid it out in front of us and showed us the names of all the teachers through the lineage with their name at the end. And I remember being completely flooded with nothing but gratitude. I just could hardly contain it. And I cried all the way home. I remember too a Sagaki retreat where my teacher Gyokoko Carlson was chanting at the festival for the Hungry Ghosts. And I don't even know what she was chanting, But the back doors were open. It was a windy day. The air was rushing through the Zendo. Her hair was kind of blowing a little bit. People were chanting all around her. And I looked at her face, and she was looking right at the altar with this look of fierce determination, fierce commitment, solidity, confidence, and chanting something I didn't even understand. No maku sanman, no mota bandai, or whatever that phrase is. I'm probably. And I remember looking at her face. She was right in front of me, and I was so amazed. I thought, this is just fantastic. This woman that's given her life to this practice so that people like me could even be here and discover this. How many of you have touched moments of great joy or great gratitude or great enthusiasm at any point in your practice? Raise your hand. There have been times I've been on my way to the Zendo and I've thought, ugh, do I really have to go? Ugh. Will I be missed if I turn around and don't go? Will anybody even notice that I wasn't there? You know, do I have to be at the meeting afterward? They'll probably be fine at the meeting without me. And I've walked up the steps and I've walked into the Zendo and I've been looking at my watch thinking, when can I leave? When can I get on with other things I really need to do today? An agitation, almost a resentment, kind of a fighting with and a fighting against my practice. How many of you have ever felt that in any way? Raise your hand. There have been times I've sat on the cushion and thought, for goodness sakes, ring the damn bell. I cannot tell you the number of hours I sat in the old Zendo at my temple and studied the stained glass patterns out of sheer and utter boredom. But the same windows. It wasn't even a different window. The same windows over time. Trying to occupy myself quietly and with stillness until the bell rang. And I was absolutely certain that the bellkeeper had had a heart attack, or they had fallen asleep, or they were in a coma and they had forgotten. And, you know, I had to have been sitting there for hours or days. And was somebody going to get up and wake them up and tell them to ring the bell? Because it had to be 8 o'clock at night. How many of you have ever sat on your cushion and just, in some way or another, felt your skin crawl, thinking, enough of this. Ring it already. How many? There have been phases in my practice when my Sangha disappointed me. When my teacher disappointed me. When somebody hurt my feelings. When somebody said something or didn't say something. Did something or didn't do something, or treated me roughly, or invited me or didn't invite me, called on me or overlooked me, said the wrong thing, I thought, and it hurt my feelings, or it made me mad, or at the least it irritated me. And sometimes it was my teacher. I remember a time I marched up the steps of Dharmarine Zen Center to sit down to tell my teacher what for. I was mad about it. So I don't know that all of us get mad, but whether it's mad or hurt or irritated, how many of you over the course of your practice have experienced something like that? relative to your Sangha and or your teacher? Raise your hand. My teacher taught me that all of those things, my moments of tremendous gratitude, my moments of looking at my teacher's face, blowing in the wind, chanting at the festival of hungry ghosts, the times I cried on my way home because I was so full of gratefulness, the times I was mad, the times I was bored, the times I resented being there. He told me that all of it was, He taught me that my job was to look at it, to watch it, to reflect on it, to see what happened with it, to watch where it went, to just hold it lightly. Hold it like this, not like this. He taught me that just because I think it doesn't make it true. Just because I feel it doesn't make it true. He taught me that grasping and clinging to the highs was just as dangerous and risky as grasping and clinging to the lows. He taught me that trying to hold on to, be greedy about, try to capture and not lose the marvelous feelings, the moments of insight, were as delusional as the times I tried with all my might to keep the negative away. That my job was simply to turn toward it. To look at it, to reflect on it, and watch where it went. I haven't always practiced that way. I sure have spent my share of time fighting off things that do not please me, trying to rush through the times of boredom or tedium or frustration or hurt so that I could get over them quickly, trying to push my way through that to the other side. I've also spent a fair amount of time trying to bask in and hold the feelings of warmth and love and generosity and compassion that I've touched and tried mightily for them not to go away. But he told me both were ill-advised. Neither was helpful. I hear people often that are newer to practice, that are in the initial stages of discovery, perhaps the wow phase or the initial discovery phase, talk about how much impact their practice has had in 2 weeks. Or how much joy or equanimity they've uncovered in 30 days. Or how amazing the one-day intro retreat was they attended last week and how their life is already so much better. And I don't want to be the curmudgeonly older practitioner who kind of sneers in the back and thinks, oh, get ready. Just wait. You don't know what's coming your way. I don't want to discount it or dismiss it. I don't want to dash it. I don't want to kind of make it be something other than it is. But I have to be honest, I have come to be a little nervous because I want and hope that we are clear with ourselves and with each other that for this practice to be transformative, we are instructed to be in this for the long haul. How does that strike you? When I reflect on the Pali Canon and what it was that Shakyamuni taught, or what it is that he is supposed to have taught, or what it is several hundred years later, people that wrote it down said he taught, there's nothing about that teaching that strikes me as a quick fix. There's nothing about that teaching that is superficial. There is nothing about that teaching that holds out promise of quick relief, quick success, quick results. Nothing. There is nothing about that teaching that guarantees steady, unrequited, never-ending peace and calm and equanimity. Nothing. And there's nothing about it that smacks of buy a book, read it, and you're good. Come to a workshop, take notes, you're good. Now that might sound harsh, and I don't mean to dismiss the possibility that one-day workshops are helpful and useful and can be beneficial, or that buying a book and reading it can be helpful, useful, and beneficial. But there's a difference between dipping our toe in this water. There's a difference between people like me who came because I thought there was one little piece of my life missing and I needed to fill it so then it could be full. There's a difference between coming and kind of dancing and flirting with the practice. There's a difference between coming and staying as long as we feel good and leaving when we don't, and coming to this practice to transform our lives. I don't know about you, but I'm here to transform my life. And sometimes the reality of that is a slog. But you know what? Sometimes my marriage was a slog. Sometimes my job feels like a slog. Sometimes my relationships with some of my family members on occasion feels like a slog. There have been some times I had a few health things pop up and that felt like a slog. There were times I met with my retirement planner and I thought, oh my God, how long am I going to have to work? And I've worked in nonprofit all my life and I haven't saved enough money. And I'm like, you're telling me I need to save more money and I got to work until I'm 128. And that feels like a slog. There are times when taking care of my dogs felt like a slog. I mean, it's sometimes slog. But if we're here to transform our lives, we are assured ebbs and flows, ups and downs, ins and outs in our practice. And our responsibility with all of it is to turn toward it, take a look at it, and say, huh, all right then. So with that, let me read you this quote again. The changes that occur through spiritual practice are not really your business. If you make them your business, you will try to change your life directly. If you try to change your life directly, no matter how long you work at it, you will not satisfy yourself. So, if you truly want to change your life, you should just form the routine of doing small things day by day. Then your life will be changed beyond your expectations. There is no explanation for this. What do you think? Let's open it up to comment and questions. And I also can monitor chat if I'm supposed to do that. What do you think? In the room or online?
I have a question. You're going to have to repeat it properly, but...
We have a question in the room?
I love the quote. I just get hung up right at the very end. There is no explanation for this. Can you talk about that a little further? Yeah. Any insight into what he was talking about?
So I think the question is the very last phrase in the quote, there is no explanation for this. And what is that? And do I have any thoughts on that? I think we probably shouldn't overthink it or overanalyze it. When I read it, and this doesn't mean this is the truth of it, but when I read it, it just is pointing to just the mystery of it all, that we are aspiring to this big spiritual thing, and the reality of it is kind of a day-to-day slog. And this is where the transformation comes over time, as opposed to all of this. And there's a bit of mystery to that, and there's no explanation for this. That's kind of what I make of it. Whether that's right or not, I don't know. Others of you, ebbs in your practice, flows in your practice, the highs, the lows, what you did, how you navigated those. I invite you to unmute and share. Are you usually a chatty group or are you usually not a chatty group? I'm accustomed to very chatty groups, which doesn't mean, you know, it is what it is. Chatty, not chatty, it's all good. Whatever. So do this. Think about this moment. Does your practice feel like an ebb? Or does it feel like a flow? Or does it feel kind of just a practical, pragmatic doing it? At this moment, not 10 years, not 5 years, just now. Mark.
Coming to you from deep in the slog. Right now definitely feels like, I don't know that ebb is even the right word for it. Right now, it just feels like there's nothing to do but sit zazen and keep the precepts and live the best life you can and then die. Which, you know, easier said than done, right? And there's a sense of like, well, if that's all there is to it, then why all this steam? Why all this energy? Why all this hurry? And in that sense, right, like having that expectation or that sense of ownership over change is a good way to have a head of steam build up. And so I'm looking at this lack of steam and being like, well, that's weird. When you don't own the results of your practice, where does the heart that practices come from?
Great great question. What do you think? How do you answer that question?
At the moment, my answer is it's buried in the very nature of being an ordinary being. Mm. Right? An ordinary being senses that life is precious. An ordinary being senses that they want to live well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit strange to have the sense of desperation and hurry drop off.
Mm.
Because there is way less energy there. I'm sort of suspicious about that situation. So I don't know if I want to call that an ebb or not, but it's definitely different.
Well, my teacher, were he alive today, would say, huh. That was one of his tried and true responses. Huh. Look at that. Turn toward that. See what happens with that. I can tell you that part of what you say, and I don't know if I'm projecting into it or, you know, thinking I'm hearing things I'm not, but I feel like I relate to some of what you're saying, because for some time now, my practice has felt, what's the right word? It hasn't felt urgent and passionate and filled with energy and drive. It really hasn't for quite a while. It's felt, I'm not saying it's felt boring and tedious in the other extreme, but it's felt very kind of middle road. It's felt very practical. It's felt very, okay, this is in front of me right now. Okay, when was the last time I sat? Huh, what about that precept? Huh, that didn't go very well. I didn't do a very good job with that precept. Well, how am I going to do it differently next time? It's felt kind of practical. And there was a time when that used to worry me, you know, when I lost the great energy and the whole practice like your hair is on fire kind of theme. I would get nervous. I was like, oh no, what's wrong? What have I done? It isn't working. I'm not as committed. And I just don't feel that way anymore. I gave myself permission to adopt a pace that would be sustainable for a lifetime. I don't know about you, but I just can't sustain a passionate pace over a lifetime. I'm good with that. Say?
I said, that's all very resonant. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Brian.
I used to particularly treasure things that surprised me, you know, whether it was a particular meal or a wine or something that I was listening to or something that I read or something that someone said. And the thing I had realized as you were talking is that there is still sort of a mystery for me in sitting, in that I don't really know that I will sometimes surprise myself. And the self who comes out of sitting seems in some way novel. And so I realized that there is lurking in me that not exactly an expectation of surprise, but a wondering what will unfold in me, you know, through the process, what will arise, what will, and, you know, that adds a certain kind of piquancy to it. So.
That sounds kind of fun. I don't know if it strikes you that way, but as I listen to it, I think, wow, that's kind of cool. Sounds cool. Or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. So, but I guess that's part of the mystery. I'm not sure how that evolves or kind of how to characterize it. But that's, you know, sort of a substrate.
Interesting. You know, another thing for me is that for some years now, I have been a lot more interested in my practice off the cushion than on the cushion. And I don't mean to make this be an either or, because it's obviously not an either or. It's not, you know, one or the other, it's both. But I guess I spent so many years in my practice focused on my experience on the cushion and, you know, what is happening and am I doing it right and what does this mean and what am I learning and what do I do with all of this stuff that's coming up. It was so focused on my experience on and coming out of the cushion. I felt like I was kind of missing the practical implementation of it in the world, kind of the precept practice, actually. So I've just become a lot more interested for me in how I am living my life day to day in conjunction with the precepts, how I am behaving, how I am speaking, how I'm thinking, how I'm moving through the world. That's been of more interest to me recently, in recent years, than what's happening on the cushion. But that also sounds like it's a, you know, dichotomy, which it's not, but it's just one of the kind of twists and turns in my own practice. Others of you, yeah.
Comment. I think it's really lovely when practice on the cushion is not completely overwhelmed with distraction. Mm-hmm. I feel like, well, this is a sweet spot. Like, mm-hmm. Those times are really lovely, but I feel like over the years, the times where I've had to really drag myself to the cushion and mm-hmm. I just didn't want to sit, those have been the times when maybe a little insight comes. Mm. Or just something, yeah, I don't know, maybe just something magical happens, something.
Did all of you hear that? Could you hear that? Yes, no? Yes, you could, okay. So the idea that times we don't want to go to the cushion, that we resist going to the cushion, when we're kind of avoiding going to the cushion, and we actually do go in those moments, that those can be particularly fruitful sometimes, particularly informative. We actually have a chance to sit and kind of reflect on what that resistance was about. Someone writes in chat, my practice feels ordinary, no special fire. Kind of like doing my teeth or getting a glass of water. And somebody else says something that I can't quite scroll up to.
I was wondering if you put the chat in the chat, the quote that you said in the beginning and at the end.
To type. Can I type the quote in the chat? Is that what you're saying?
Or someone.
Yeah. I can't. It's a long quote, and I can't chat it now, but I will share it with you after the fact. I'm sorry. I'm going to send it to you after the fact. How about that? I have a long quote. If I try, and I'm a bad typist, and if I try to type it now, it's going to be... It's going to be a disastrous situation for sure. You know, the teachings, Shakyamuni's teachings and all the writings that followed are replete with what seem on the surface to be kind of contradictory instruction about our practice. So, you know, we read in the scripture, practice like your hair's on fire. So in other words, get on with it. Dokken writes, you have been given the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. I don't know how that strikes you, but that strikes me as get on with it. This is an incredible opportunity you have because you happen to be in human form at this time. That's an amazing opportunity. Don't waste it. Get on with it. There are all kinds of writings and teachings that point toward an energy and a zeal and a commitment and a determination and basically some version of get on with it. Great energy. And then there's all this teaching at the same time about non-effort, about don't practice with any thought of gain, no thought of gain. All this teaching about don't cling or grasp anything. So it's kind of, depending on the mood you're in and depending on where you are in your life and your practice, it can either be affirming or it can be a little challenging. And in typical Zen fashion, it's almost, you know, always yes and yes, both and this. This is useful and instructive, and also this, useful and instructive and true. Somebody in chat writes, interesting, I wonder if the ordinariness isn't a function of whether there's something stuck in your teeth. Ooh, or if you're especially thirsty. If it were, then maybe it would affect that quality of ordinariness to something different. Interesting. So it's one thing to reach out and just grab a glass of water when everything is fine. If your throat's on fire and you've been dehydrated for 3 days because you're ill and you reach out and take a glass of water, that's a different taking a glass of water. So even taking a glass of water can be urgent and full of effort and a little dire. It can be incredibly ordinary. Yes.
All of this talk of just no effort, you know, that kind of thing. I actually encountered that when I was a teenager, and it turned me off right away.
Hmm.
You know, because I thought, oh, you know, what do you mean? You're just going to sit around and let life happen to you, and not do anything, and just be lazy. You know? But as I've gotten more into the practice, I've realized that maybe that's just a form of upaya, that that's a skillful mean to take this conditioned human existence where we're, everything is go, 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 make, do, you know, that we need to hear the opposite of that to bring ourselves to that place of balance and equanimity, to kind of counteract, like a medicine, right? Like the Buddha even said, you know, dispensing good medicine, like a physician, to say, no, don't worry about that. To bring us to that place where we can say, oh, you know, rather than feeling like we have to jump in and react and to be able to get that distance from it. And I've been getting that a lot lately with my, you know, talking about off the cushion. My wife has had a lot of difficulties in her job with changes in the organization and all this. And a lot of it's been impacting her emotionally at times. And I've had to be the one to say these words like, hey, just right now, just try to detach from it, try to, you know, get some perspective on it, try to not take it personally, you know, go with the flow, and all these things. And I hear these words coming out of my mouth, and I say, well, that sounds a lot like, you know, what the teachings have been saying. And here I'm kind of trying to help her. So that's the way that all that has struck me at least.
Huh. The concept of expedient means and the idea that Shakyamuni taught repeatedly, which is the right teaching for the right person at the right time. Sounds like. So perhaps the right medicine for you at a particular time is get on with it. Practice like your hair is on fire. Don't waste your days and nights in vain. Hurry up. Perhaps at a different time, the right medicine is, huh, isn't that interesting? Huh, maybe you might want to reflect on the teaching of practice with no sense of gain. And maybe we could be in the same sangha sitting on cushions immediately next to each other, and that could be the right medicine for you, and this could be the right medicine for me at the same time. Because certainly when we think about ebbs and flows of practice, you're flowing when I'm ebbing, and I'm ebbing when you're flowing, and we're crisscrossing, and we're whatever, and I'm happy, and you're tough, and I'm having a bad time, and you're having a great time. That's part of the beauty of practicing in Sangha, is that we're kind of bumping into each other, and we're kind of dancing around each other, and we're meeting, and we're disconnecting, and we're reflecting each other, and we're seeing ourselves in each other, and we're reacting to each other, and we're growing and changing with each other, and we're being seen in all of our good and all of our talents and our gifts, and we're being seen in our idiosyncrasies and our shortfalls and our foibles. And that is part of the amazing beauty of Sangha, in the incredibly powerful instruction that comes in Sangha. And the reason we are taught that Sangha is the third leg of the stool of the triple treasure, that if we practice, we need to be in relationship with Sangha. That's in fact where a lot of the practice occurs. So again, this idea that I'm going to kind of go off to my cabin in the woods, and I'm going to sit on a cushion and think calming thoughts and calm myself down, and that is the extent of my practice, is really not quite the teaching. Not that sitting by ourselves in a cabin in the woods is not a good thing to do, but that it alone is insufficient. But there are a lot of ebbs and flows that come with Sangha. You ever been mad at your Sangha? I've been mad at my Sangha. Any other thoughts in the room? Online. Do I think the online Sangha is enough for the third leg? I think if the online Sangha is what we can do right now, then it's enough. I think if it's as comfortable as people can be, and this is what they're willing to do, and this is how they're comfortable participating, it's sufficient. I think for other people that are willing or comfortable to kind of do the in-person thing, great. I think Sangha can take many forms. But I do think the teaching is clear that being in relationship in Sangha is an incredibly important part of our practice, although it certainly comes with a lot of ebbs and flows. You know, you throw a bunch of people in a room, all our karmic stuff is going to eventually start to bump into each other. The abbot of my temple, Dharma Rain, Kakumyo, whenever we talk about the messiness of Sangha and the messiness of all our karmic baggage kind of bumping up against each other and rough elbows and dashed expectations and just the messiness of that, he always says, bring it on. And that's the view, that there is so much richness in that. So much to learn and experience and reflect on that. It's really rich, fruitful. Somebody else said something in chat. Ordinary is in part of habit, energy of daily life, needed, wanted to do, not yet as a desperation, as Brian describes, more as grasping. Got it. Okay. So this is more just kind of expanding on the idea of just a glass of water, just a bite of food, just using the restroom, getting up and walking down the hall. So I'll leave you with the tremendous wisdom, the great teaching, the love and compassion of my teacher. The next time you feel a great flow, I hope you greet it with a big, huh. And the next time you feel a tremendous ebb, I hope you turn toward it, and I hope you greet it with a big, huh. And my hope is, ebb or flow or something in between, keep at it. It's tremendous beauty in the slog. So with that, there is some quote that I am supposed to read. Would you make me a show, please? Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones,
Bodhisattvas,
Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. I wish you well on your journey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you.